Fire rescue, EMS, law enforcement. These are the three components of public safety, and those who answer the call are the first responders. Welcome to another episode of Five Alarm Task Force with your host, Steve Green. Five Alarm Task Force presents some of the best instructors, leaders, and mentors in public safety today to educate, elucidate, and entertain. No topic is out of bounds, and every opinion has value. Five Alarm Task Force is brought to you by Five Alarm Task Force Corp. One family, one mission. First responders helping each other. And our sponsors, Insight Training LLC, your best bet for fire service tick training. The Firehouse Tribune, where you can expand your horizons in emergency services and learn to work hard, stay safe, and live inspired. LifeScan Wellness Centers, saving the lives of America's heroes. And our promotional partners, Chief Miller Products and Sites, Thin Red Line Decon Products, making decontamination as simple as possible for you with decon wipes, shampoo, body wash, and more. Haas Alert, creator of the safety cloud for our roads. Fry Guy Levers and Nestor Bars, the amazing new hand tools for the fire service. Silver Arrow Coaching and Consulting, unlock your potential from burnout to brilliance. Crackle Magazine, serving the International Fire Service. EFT Corporation, 40 plus years of innovation in donation and payment processing solutions. Health KPI, teaching you how to track the right data to stay at the top of your game. The Firefighter Cancer Foundation, fighting to extinguish firefighter cancer since 2004. The Firefighter Cancer Support Network. The Albemarle Sweet Shop, the North Florida Fire Expo, and the Great Florida Fire School. Remember, our ultimate goal is for you to be safe and return home after every call. So insert those earphones or turn up those speakers. The Five Alarm Task Force is being dispatched right now.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Five Alarm Task Force. I'm your host, Steve Green. Happy to be here with you and happy to have you here with us. My guest today is Dr. Dustin Lambert, also known as Dusty. And we're going to be talking about an article that he wrote for Firehouse and was part of his dissertation. And he'll be with us in just a few moments. If you enjoy this podcast and you'd like to listen to more, well, you can listen to all our audio podcasts, over 210 of them, available usually on most of the major podcast platforms. And if you can't find them on your favorite platform, you can visit our website at www.5-alarmtaskforcecorp.org. And when you're on that page, just go to the horizontal menu at the top and click on the tab that says podcast, and that will bring you to our library. And if you want to watch more of our video interviews, going back to 2020, late 2020, we started is on our YouTube channel. Again, the same name, basically, the numeral 5-Alarm Task Force Corp. And you'll see our videos there. Now, when you're on our website, we hope that you may want to sign up to receive our newsletters. It comes out about 4 or 5 times a year. We had one for the summer. We don't send spam. We don't sell or give away your email addresses. We protect them under the laws of the state of Florida and the federal government. So if you ever want to unsubscribe, all you have to do is send an email to dalmatprod@outlook.com with the word unsubscribe in the subject line, and we'll take you off right away. Again, a big thanks to our friends at Facebook. Oh my goodness, the numbers keep crawling up and up and up, and we cannot thank you enough. We love having you follow us. We love having you like us. We still need your help, Facebook and all our listeners, to raise some money here so we can help firefighters. We've just had another line of duty death that occurred over the weekend. Two firefighters that were seriously injured in an overturned apparatus accident just over a month ago. And one of those firefighters passed away from her injuries. So it's our job, we feel, with our podcast to and our nonprofit to get some money to that family to help them out right away. And we'll be doing that research this week so we can help them. But we need your help as well. Now, many of you listen to us on major podcast platforms, and some of you listen to us on these, some of these minor platforms. But most of the large platforms provide the listeners with an opportunity to leave a review, either using stars, like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 stars, or a sentence or two about the podcast or what you liked about it. And that's very important, not just to us here at Five Alarm Task Force, but to all podcasters, because when you do a search for a particular podcast, depending on those reviews that you have, the platforms create their algorithm based on really good reviews, or and you have high results. If you don't have good reviews, you don't have any reviews, you're going to be very low in that results list. So please, if you have a moment and you listen to the podcast, please just take a moment or two to leave a star rating or a sentence or two, and don't be afraid to leave constructive criticism, because we want to know what you want from us and what we can do to bring you the best educators and instructors and teachers and personalities in the fire service today. And that's it. That's our business for today. So we'll be back with our guest, Dr. Dustin Lambert, right after these words. As always, please stay tuned.
New technology for the fire service seems to appear almost every day, and that technology demands a learning curve, especially if we're talking about thermal imaging cameras. That's where Insight Fire Training LLC is your best bet. With an excellent reputation across the U.S., Insight Fire Training will meet all your TIC training needs. Their curriculum is peer-reviewed and has been used internationally. Their instructors are Level 1 Thermography Certified, and they have taught in 33 states and 4 countries. Their courses run from introductory to training the trainers. Courses are available online, for the classroom, classroom hybrid, and even live fire. Insight Training LLC is proficient in over 40 thermal imaging cameras, so you feel confident they will know your make and model. Best of all, programs are customized to your specific needs, and their cadre of fire service veterans are vetted craftsmen of Project Kill the Flashover. They are so proficient that they have trained TIC manufacturers on how to best use and sell their own product. That's Insight Fire Training LLC. Look them up on InsightTrainingLLC.com. Your best bet for TIC training.
Would you like to meet up with Andy and the team from Insight Training LLC? Well, here's part of their upcoming schedule. This coming week, September 15th through the 17th, Insight Training instructor Andy Starnes is grateful for the opportunity to be invited to speak at the First in Fire Conference in Arkansas. Details and additional information will be relayed soon. You can follow them on Facebook for more details, facebook.com/profile.P=H=D=D=100005714780262668. And coming up, the big week in September, Firehouse Expo 2023 in Columbus, Ohio. Insight Training is truly grateful and honored to return to Firehouse Expo 2023. They will be providing the following: a live fire hot class led by instructor Joey Baxa and the Insight Training cadre on September 25th and 26th. A large booth at the expo with demonstrations throughout the conference. Classroom sessions offered by instructors Andy Starnes, Reagan Underwood, and Joey Baxa. Intelligently aggressive fire attack. Thursday, September 28th at 9:15 a.m., Andy Starnes, founder, owner, Insight Training LLC, will be the speaker. Training Day, Training May Day, I Was Not Ready for This, on Wednesday, September 27th at 11 a.m. with Reagan Underwood, captain with the St. George Fire Department. No Excuses, Tactics for the Understaffed Department. Wednesday, September 27th at 9:15 a.m. with Joey Baxa, captain, Buchanan Fire Department. Always be sure to check the InsightTrainingLLC.com website for more details. Remember, Insight Training, LLC, your best bet for tick training. The Firehouse Tribune has expanded, now bringing you podcasts, presentations, and training blogs. The Firehouse Tribune is an innovative way for emergency services professionals to interact, share ideas, learn, and train. We are inspired by those who came before us and built a path for us to share knowledge and experience with the rest of the emergency services world, where life experiences and training come together. Check out our podcasts, Station Talk, and the 5-Tool Firefighter Podcast. Want us to speak at your department or event? Reach out to us to set up workshops at your firehouse or virtual event on topics including the 5-Tool Firefighter, 5 Key Attributes of the Well-Rounded Firefighter, and 6 Tips to Guide the New Fire Officer. Don't forget, you can follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and LinkedIn, and be sure to subscribe to our YouTube channel. For more info, please visit www.thefirehousetribune.com or email us at fhtribunepodcast@gmail.com. The New Firehouse Tribune Services, where we live by one motto, not just in emergency services, but in life. Excellence is a habit, not a goal. Here's a shout out for our good friend Nick Higgins of the Firehouse Tribune and Station Talk. Just to let you know that Nick is going to be at the October 25th to 28th EMS and Fire Expo at Foxwoods Resort Casino in Connecticut. Join them there at the Expo on October 28th, where Nick will be presenting his topic, The 5-Tool Firefighter, 5 Key Attributes to a Well-Rounded Firefighter, at the Foxwoods Resort and Casino. This presentation is based on his book, The 5-Tool Firefighter. So you don't want to miss it. Go to the Fire Tribune, FH Tribune, or Firehouse Tribune website for more information and to book your place right now. We're firefighters. We're law enforcement. But like everyone else, we have our aches and pains, sometimes from the job and sometimes not. We realize there are risks with this job. However, sometimes something is wrong with us and we don't know it. Now what do? Well, LifeScan Wellness Centers are dedicated to saving America's heroes. For most fire and police organizations, LifeScan Wellness Centers will send one of their mobile teams to assess every member of your department with complete and complex physical exams and blood work. Using state-of-the-art medical equipment, LifeScan staff members provide a multi-procedural exam, including cardiac stress tests, basic lab results, and ultrasound exams. LifeScan Wellness exams have saved the lives of dozens of firefighters and police officers across the country. They have found tumors, aortic bulges, lung problems, and more, many of which were asymptomatic. However, early detection allowed most of these colleagues to have their personal medical professionals mitigate the health issue that otherwise might have led to a darker time. For more information, please visit their website at lifescanwellness.com. Remember, LifeScan Wellness Centers, saving the lives of America's heroes. Hello, and welcome to this episode of 5-Alarm Task Force. If you're watching the video, if you were listening to the audio, well, you heard the intro, and we are happy to be with you again today. My name is Steve Green. I'm your host. And my guest today is, I don't quite remember, maybe it was from Nick Higgins from Firehouse Tribune, but this gentleman's name is Dr. Dustin Lambert, doctor with a PhD. He has over 22 years of fire and emergency services experience, 20 of which have been at the Fairmont, West Virginia Fire Department, where he is currently a captain. He is an adjunct instructor at the National Fire Academy in Responder Safety and Health Curriculum, a fire instructor for the West Virginia Public Service Training and EMS instructor at Pierpoint Community and Technical College. He holds a doctorate in emergency management from Jacksonville State University, a master's degree in safety management from West Virginia University, a bachelor's degree in occupational safety from Fairmont State University, and he is an FAA licensed private pilot. His research expertise is in responder safety and health, focusing on human factors and emergency vehicle crashes. Now, I just mentioned in the intro that I recorded for will be the audio version of the show, is that unfortunately over the weekend we had a line of duty death, one of the two firefighters in Louisa County, Virginia, who were severely injured in a vehicle rollover last month. One of them, she passed, lost her life over the weekend. So we, as a nonprofit side of Five Alarm Task Force Corp, will vet the story and then reach out and help out. But this is one of the things that when I read the news on Saturday, that I realized how important, and I guess fortuitous it was that I had you booked for today. Because, and folks, those of you watching and listening, what Dusty did in his, in an article he did for Firehouse and as part of his dissertation, the topic, he has a great name for it, is driving under the influence of dispatch. Now, if you were, especially if you were a volunteer, but, and you were driving in your own vehicle to get to the station, but even a career firefighter who's an engineer or a driver for the heavy rescue, whatever, we tend to get a little excited about answering a call. You never see us just sloth our way out of the day room to get on the truck. No, we're out the door, got our gear on, ready to roll. And that driver is driving, hopefully with a good officer next to him or her, and keeping an eye out on that roadway. But the problem is, when I started in North Carolina, they have this great phrase, being eat up with it. And when we start out, whether we're career, volunteer, part pay, even WUI, we get excited. This is something we chose to do. It's the calling that we feel, and we get excited. And that's great because that makes you want to do your job better, but that can also play a negative role. We've seen it. We've all heard about it. Sometimes you want to just hide it under the rug because, oh, well, that's not really that important. Yeah, it is that important. And Dustin, you're here to tell us just why it was so important to you that actually basing part of your dissertation on this very topic.
Yeah, sadly, it's still very relevant and has been relevant for decades. I mean, there's, you know, technology and a lot of things have changed in emergency services. But the one thing that has been consistent is very quickly delivering our services to somebody's doorstep, wherever that may be. So, and I don't see that changing for next few years anyway. I don't think drones are quite going to replace anything yet. So, yeah, sadly, it's, you know, still leading cause of traumatic death across the board for even law enforcement. It parallels with violence. Acts of violence, it for traumatic death, it's right up there. So it's across all branches.
Right. Yeah. We've been seeing it, unfortunately, a couple of times in the last couple of months with EMS as well.
Yeah.
Where it wasn't necessarily the EMS mistake, but there was another driver who didn't yield to lights and sirens and blew through an intersection and hit the transport unit. And we've had a loss of life, whether it was the patient in the ambulance, or is one of our brothers and sisters in EMS, whatever it is, it's too much. You know, we don't need, we face enough danger of in the job we do. We don't need to elevate it by playing, you know, we're still the cowboy on the range back in the late 1800s.
Yeah, it's you know, we risk a lot to save a lot, but when do you assume that risk? And too many people think that we assume that right from the start, right when we hear the dispatch, but really, how many times are dispatches spot on correct anyway? They're not real accurate a lot of times. So we can't really assume that risk until we safely get there. And you know, to compound the problem, really what was eye-opening, one of the scariest statistics for me is how much more fatal emergency vehicle crashes, fire apparatus crashes are to civilians than they are to us. I mean, yeah, they're dangerous to us, and that's a blatant problem, but we're killing around 10 civilians for every one firefighter. So when you see that one firefighter fatality, there's, you know, 10 other fatalities out there of a fire truck that creamed a vehicle, and the fire truck's always going to win, you know, that lug nut. So we miss that a lot of times when we start looking at the fatalities in the fire service. We forget all the other people that are dying in crashes that didn't kill a firefighter. So that's also needs to be weighed considerably in the equation and the liability of it. The financial side. I mean, if you ask an attorney, of course, that's the way that they're going to see everything. But that's a huge, huge issue with maintaining, you know, insurance. I mean, insurance companies realize this. They know that we like to pile stuff up and crash. So yeah, that's huge liability for them and for us in the emergency services.
Right. So let me ask you this. I mean, this has been a topic, you know, as we said before we even start recording, that this is nothing new for us. We see good leaders like Chief Billy Goldfeder, Dennis Rubin, Dan Kerrigan, you know, our mutual friends, Andy Starnes, Nick Higgins. You know, we've all talked about this. We've seen this, but I don't think we give it enough weight and consideration. But what was it the trigger for you personally that you said, you know, you have your master's degree is in
safety management. My bachelor's master's safety management. Safety, yeah.
Right. So what lit that fire for you that said, you know, this topic is really important to me. You're a captain in your department, so you're sitting in that right seat, but I'll guarantee that you're probably a certified engineer as well. So you were driving in the left seat.
Yep.
What was that point where you said, this is bad, I got to do something about this educationally?
That's an excellent question. I don't think I could have given you a better question. So, yeah, my background in safety, and then I switched to emergency management for my doctorate. So I wanted to sort of marry those two fields. And I had been a firefighter for 14, 15 years when I started into that program. And, you know, going into a PhD program, you aren't real sure of what your research is going to be, but you kind of have a rough idea. And I didn't know for much of the coursework. But two things had really sort of been blaring over here and blaring over here, and I didn't really make those come together until later on. So vehicle crashes just in general are, I think, universal, not even emergency vehicle crashes, but if you're going to give an example of a safety problem to you know, a freshman class coming in a safety program, everybody's rode in a vehicle before, so they know, you know, seat belts and road conditions. And so I think that when you look at that, everybody can relate to it on some level. So I think that was always intriguing to me. And of course that rolls over into emergency vehicle crashes too, because it's universal. We all do it. If I was going to make the biggest impact for emergency services to reduce the loss of life, of course we have the health side, which is our cardiac, stress-related events, cancers. I'm not a physician, so I'm not going to approach those. They're being handled very well by, you know, great professionals at NIOSH doing some great research. So look over into the safety side, thinking traumatic injuries. Well, let's pick the biggest issue that's facing us, and that's emergency vehicle crashes on the trauma side. So that was a problem that I wanted to look into and wanted to solve. At the same time, I was working on my private pilot's license. And looking at, even at the most basic level, they sort of hammer into you some of the big risk factors for aviation crashes. And those, just like emergency vehicle crashes, are human factors. So like, okay, that's interesting going on over here. And this is interesting to me going on over here. So then I started looking at those human factors. And one of the things that they really hammer on you for aviation is the outside pressures. So you fly a couple states away, you go to a business meeting, and it's time to go home, but weather's looking sort of marginal, but you got to be at work the next morning, and you promised your wife you'd be there, and you know it's sort of iffy. You know what, I'm gonna go ahead and get to the airport and fly home, and weather gets worse, and crash a plane. And that happens over and over and over and over still today. Those external pressures, you know, encourage pilots to fly. So like, oh, that's interesting. And I can totally see that. And then it started to kind of come together to look at that. How does that apply to emergency vehicle crashes and to the emergency services? And that was sort of what married those two interests, started to bring those together. And then the other thing to me, I went to the Redmond Symposium, which is the IAFF's safety and health symposium. They do it, I think, every 2 years. But I went to that in 2011, New York City. And one of the presenters there had just finished up research on physiological effects of firefighting. He was looking at it from an athletic point of view. He wanted to see, you know, how high do our heart rates get during fires, our respirations. So they put heart rate monitors and chest respiration monitors on a bunch of firefighters in Indianapolis. If I remember, yeah, it was in Indianapolis. And this researcher would live with the firefighters for their 24-hour shifts and monitor them and mark down whenever they would have a dispatch to different types of calls. So he would watch their heart rates at the time of dispatch, between calls, while they're en route to calls, and then while they were actually working at a structure fire. And that's really what his research was focused on, to see how high their heart rates were getting. But one of the side findings of that that really intrigued me, and I got to speak to him afterwards, that really intrigued me, was that at the time of dispatch, before you even move a muscle, when you hear the dispatch, your heart rate goes up almost as high as if you were actually at the call. So that's interesting. And there was a few other findings. The older, more senior firefighters didn't have quite have the response, that physiological response, as what the new firefighters did. Not surprising, but we have numbers to back it up now, right? We always get excited when, you know, you're a new guy, you get your first fire, like what you mentioned, you're excited to go help people. So that was interesting. And the dispatches, there was actually a difference in the dispatch to different types of calls. And this is not the first time this has been studied. Right. So, you know, your normal routine medical call or a tree down or the fender bender, yeah, you get a little bit of a heart rate escalation, but not really all that much. But when they would have a fire, you hear that four-letter F word, they would get way more amped up. And then the highest of those, when we're measuring heart rate and respirations, was entrapment, fires with entrapment.
Okay. I was going to say with a kid.
Because yes. We know those calls. Also, there's research to back that up to on the EMS side. Exact same thing. If you hear pediatrics, and that's going to apply to the fire service. I don't think he documented it down to that much detail, but I guarantee you, you're spot on with that. There is some other studies on paramedics, EMTs, who they did the same thing over there at the dispatch. It's anything to do with pediatrics and vehicle crashes. For if they're responding to a crash on the interstate, they're going to be a little more excited than they would for,
you know. In the second department I was with, it was upstate New York, and this kid who was lived a couple of houses down from us, and he was a junior firefighter when he was in high school, and he was really excited. And so he finally turned 18, and following week we had a call for a second alarm at a Burger King in the next town over. And we were just going really just to help with overhaul and stuff like that. Well, there was no other senior person there. So I made sure everybody got loaded in the back, made sure they had their CBA on and tested it. And so all of a sudden, we're maybe 5-6 minutes out of the station, maybe another 4 minutes to go. And I hear bells going off. I'm saying, what the hell is that? And the kid is going... But well, he sucked. We hadn't even gotten to the call, and he sucked his whole tank out already.
So I can see that.
I said, "Well, young man, you got a chance to learn how to change your own tank. Go to the side, see the driver, and he'll change it, and he'll work with you to change the tank for." But that's part of he was so excited about that first, you know, and he had been taught how to. He was in the class how to just test your SCBA when you put it on, make sure you get charged. He just never got past that turn it on and forgot to turn it off part
of the test.
It is. And you know, when you talked about your flying, the night that I was voted in this volunteer department in North Carolina, I sat next to this young kid who is now 40 plus years later, still my best friend. And he's a helicopter pilot. And he got his private pilot's fixed wing also, but he started with helicopters, paid his own way, never was in the military, paid his own way. He's been a chief pilot for one of the Florida County Sheriff's Office for over 25 years.
Yeah.
And he is, he's a instructor all across the country. He's a certifier, FAA certifier as well. But he is so vehement about when you fly and when you don't fly. He goes, I don't care what you think you can do. This is the way it works. And he goes, and I've got those 25 years behind me to show you that this is, you can think all you want, but thinking doesn't make those rotors turn or stop turning. So
right.
You have to know when you can fly and when you don't fly. No matter the emergency, there are times you have to say, I can't fly.
Yeah.
But we don't want to do that because right. of who we are.
Right.
We again, as we said at the beginning, it's a calling, but we have to temper that with, if we want to help these people, we have to get there safely ourselves.
Yeah.
Because if we don't, then they're going to suffer longer waiting for a backup response because we messed up. Now, no, it's not always us.
Right. Yeah.
Okay. It's not always our fault, but I think having been trained on a driver, on a engine, on what we have a snorkel, what we didn't call them quints back then, because we mounted them on a brontosaurus, so in those days. But we have an obligation to do everything we can to get to the person with the problem as quickly as possible, but realizing that we have to get there safely to be able to do our job. And he's been a very, very big proponent in the related field of air rescue and flying in law enforcement and EMS. So I'm really glad that, I guess it was Nick who gave me your name and this topic, because this is something, I've been an educator for over 50 years. And one of the things that I loved in reading your bio was that you're into as much into education as I am. We don't have a lot of firefighters that go on to get PhDs. They get their CFOs, okay, and that's great, and I think that's important. But we don't have a lot that want to go get a master's and get a PhD. I know I have one who lives here in Florida, has become a good friend also. But I think that you took it wasn't a dare, but you took a forward step that a lot of people in the business aren't willing to really take. As I said, we have some great leaders who do underscore that in a lot of their postings, or especially right after there's been an accident, they talk about it. But again, I think sometimes, as good as we are in trying to take care of the people of our communities, sometimes we forget about some of the edgier side of what we have to do to take care of ourselves and those people on the way to our calls.
Yeah. Yeah. You're spot on there. And thank you for that. That was quite a compliment. I appreciate it. And I don't know if I ever thought of it that way. Really, maybe I think my education became a habit at some point. So I'm just like, well, now what? I guess I'll keep going. But yeah, I really appreciate that. That was quite a compliment. And it's something that's been passionate, you know, for me for many years now. So hopefully it makes a difference. Keep getting the word out, and maybe we can get some curriculum change once we get into some of the more details of it here in a little bit.
Right. Well, that I think that's great. And I think it's important that we realize that we are not indestructible. And every time we have a line of duty death that's proven to us, we don't want to lose a brother or sister. We don't want to lose a civilian if we can do anything to prevent it. We will go to extraordinary lengths, whether it's a rescue off a 9,000-foot mountain or it's Mrs. Smith's cat in the tree one day. Yeah. Our job is to take care of the problem in as safe and expeditious a manner as we can. And if you've ever taken an EVOC class, okay, which they didn't have in my day, but our captain and our in chief were very adamant about us learning how to drive our cars, because the vast majority of us were volunteers. Luckily, I lived a third of a mile from the firehouse, so it was easy for me, and I didn't have to go crazy with it. But we need to realize that there's more at stake with every response than us and the site or the people of the response.
Yeah,
we have to get there from A. We have to go from A to B, and the last thing we wanted to do was run into C on that way.
Right. I think it was Rick Lasky, I believe, that said when he was riding in the front seat, you know, with a new guy, he would never tell them to speed up. He said, I don't care if it looks like we're going in through a parade, we're going so slow. I'll just wave at people as we go by. He's like, that's perfectly fine. You forget what's going on at the scene. You get us there safe. Then we'll hustle. You know, time is made up in the station when you're getting dressed. Time is made up on the fire ground by hustling and knowing your job. Time is not made up by driving like an idiot to get to the call.
Exactly. Exactly. So you start getting really into this. You start doing the research. You're finding the details and the facts and the data that sadly is underscoring everything you and I are talking about. And probably most of our viewers and listeners don't even know that there are details, there is data that deals with this very topic. And it's not just how many saves do we make, how many LODDs are. And I also, folks, I think we have to also underscore here, nobody is bashing anybody here. You know, when we talk about first responders, our very first responder is our call takers and dispatchers. They are the first ones talking with people calling in, not us. We don't talk to them till maybe we get to a scene, but those call takers and those dispatchers are number one. Based on the information they give us, we respond and they'll reroute us, or the GPS will reroute us to give us a fast response or help us avoid traffic or something like that. And sometimes the dispatchers are saying, well, I'm getting 10 calls now. I get 9 calls. While that's important, that's not something I believe has to be yelled and given to the dispatch units, because what you're doing is, we all know what we're doing, something dangerous, and we're going, and even just getting there is dangerous.
Yeah. But yeah. It becomes an emotional contagion at that point.
Exactly. I think
when the caller is excited, which I'm sure most of them are, and I would assume probably newer dispatchers maybe are worse about this. You can hear it in some of their voices, which you shouldn't. You're right. And I think that's where automated dispatch might come into play. But yeah, but that can be contagious to the dispatcher who gets excited as well, tries to calm themselves down, but then dispatch, you can always sometimes hear it in some of their voices for sure. So you're right.
Listen, we know it's a tough job for them, very difficult. They always sometimes have to just pry under the fingernails to get data, information to give to, you know, any of our branches to respond.
Yeah.
So it can get a little hairy for them too. And they're human. You can't. When I was finally diagnosed with one of my autoimmune disorders a year ago, I asked the doctor, how do I get rid of the symptoms? How can I avoid the symptoms? She says to me, just get rid of all the stress in your life.
Oh, that's easy.
I said, okay, well, that's easy, doc. I mean, I've been sick for 22 months without diagnosis, so I'm just finding out what's mad at me. I'm just starting medication to help me, but 9 doctors in 22 months couldn't help me. Okay, so there's no stress there. And then I run a nonprofit for the fire service to help our brothers and sisters and or their families in dire need, but there's no stress there. So I said to her, I said, doc, let me ask you a question. I said, sure. I said, let's make believe I'm your doctor. You're still a doctor. You're still a vascular surgeon. I said, and I tell you, oh, doc, I'm sorry to tell you, but you got this autoimmune disorder. Well, how do I'm a busy doctor. How do I get rid of it? Oh, just remove the stress from your life. And she goes, Oh, yeah, you're right. Yeah. It's you can't do that. And we can't simply sublimate. We don't have an auto kill switch to sublimate our emotions either. So we're human. We hear the call. We hear the dispatch. God forbid it says child down, or something like that. I don't care how long you've been a firefighter, a police officer, a paramedic or EMT. You hear those words and your heart starts beating out of your chest.
Yeah. And for officers, the similar studies showed that their high stress responses is to, anything involving weapons, which that's a given. Sure. That made sense when I read that. But it was also to back up another officer. So if an officer calls, I need help, that was what escalates theirs to level 10. I'm like, that's kind of interesting, but it makes sense also. You know, we want to help our own. I can't, that would be like for us, it would be a mayday call.
Right, so, exactly.
Yeah, okay. That, you know, that's going to give most everybody cold chills, make the hair on their neck stand up. So, yeah, it's across the board. And what you're saying about dispatchers, absolutely not bashing anybody. I've crashed some vehicles, so I'm not.
Oh, haven't we all?
Yeah.
All right. So, what was the turning point for you? Do you think that you said, you know what, this is now getting to a point where I want to do a lot more research. I want to see just what this, how prevalent this is, and what are the results of it?
Yeah. So I mentioned the human factors, kind of drawing in from aviation and maybe how they solved it. And then the human factors being the common denominator across emergency vehicle crashes. And if you think back to, you know, driver's ed, if you ever had driver's ed, if you drive defensively, the true definition of that is fundamentally, if you're in the front seat, you are responsible for that vehicle. You can't blame another vehicle for running through a stop sign because you should be anticipating that if you're driving defensively. So ultimately it comes down to human factors as being the most common cause. Yeah, you could blame crappy road conditions. Yeah, it was icy, but were you driving too fast for those road conditions? So ultimately it almost always comes down to that person in the front left seat, if you're in the US, for front left seat.
Right, right.
So we know that those human factors exist. We know that in aviation, they have the same problem. And there's some solutions in the aviation side. So something that was interesting to me is that aeromedical, there's for aeromedical dispatches, if you're flying an aeromedical helicopter or airplane in some places, the pilot is encouraged by that. This is an FAA directive. It's been around for many years to not disclose what type of call it is to the pilot. So they might know, they're going to know where they're going, and that's about it. Is it a scene flight, or is it a, you know, inner hospital? And that's all that they know. They don't know that it's a kid that rolled over a four-wheeler or a five-year-old, because then what are they going to start thinking? Oh, I've got a five-year-old at home. Yeah, that weather's a little sketchy, but we're going to go because that's our job. Of course they are. Everybody's going to do that. I mean, you're going to start risking a little bit more when you start getting caught up in your head. And that's why aeromedical has historically not had great track records. I mean, they have a lot of a higher rate of crashes. And they started looking at, you know, those outside external factors to get in there and help. So you bring that over back again to the fire emergency services, and we start looking at what are our external factors, external pressures. Well, of course, it's the dispatch, right? It's what we're hearing. And we knew that stress, we've got certain dispatches that are high stress, fires, structure fires, especially anything with entrapment. And that also includes vehicle crashes with entrapment. So if you're dispatched to that, and when I read all this, and that wasn't my work, but when I read these studies, I'm like, yeah, I could have told you that. Everybody could have told you that, like you said, with kids. Yep, everybody would. So the data isn't surprising, but it is interesting when you start seeing actual numbers there to support what you already know is true. So we know that certain dispatches cause you to be more escalated, more emotionally aroused is the technical term. than others. So then I started looking at how does that affect us? Could that stress and that mental state affect how we are thinking? And turns out it does quite a bit. It slows your judgment, it skews your judgment, literally can give you tunnel vision, auditory exclusion, which is a funny phenomenon that I've noticed for years now, is you get in the truck to respond to a call and you can't hear the darn radio. So everybody cranks it up 10, right, on the way to the call. And then you get done, wrapped up, whatever it was, and you get back in the truck to come back, and you first thing you hear on the radio, it's like, ah, why is that so loud? And you turn it back down. Well, that is the perfect example of auditory exclusion. When you're amped up, it affects what you're hearing. So you'll hear law enforcement officers say whenever they fired their weapon that they never heard the gunshots, that they were so level 10 of their emotional state that they didn't hear them. So they think that their gun's malfunctioning, even though they just, you know, fired 10 rounds and they didn't even notice it. So it can really affect our mental state. And that is perhaps most apparent when we are driving to scenes. So that sort of got me thinking, well, how can I measure this? And when you get into a doctoral program, they stress to you that you aren't out to solve the world's problems. You know, you're going to start with a very broad topic and we're going to narrow it down. We're going to narrow it down to where you have this little tiny slice of the pie of knowledge that you're contributing to the world. And it might be one little piece of data. And they assure you that that's okay. Because you know, you're a tooth in the gear of the bigger machine. So you're contributing your part. So I'm like, okay, what kind of data is already out there that maybe I can draw from to draw some conclusions? Cause I could have went and gathered my own, but you know, we're fortunate in the US to where we do have really good records, especially with emergency services. So I wanted to look at crashes. I wanted to look at what were they responding to when the crash occurred. So I suppose if I had data from an insurance company, I probably could have a much bigger data set. But what I had available was from the U.S. Fire Administration, and that's firefighter fatalities. We have good records of that. They actually actively pursue that. You've also got NIOSH that investigates firefighter fatalities. They don't do all of them, and they're actually selective about what they do. A lot of people don't realize that. So they can sort of pick and choose. So they have very detailed reports. I'm sure you've read the line of duty death reports from NIOSH, but you know, multiple pages of everything leading up to great data, but it's not for every fatal crash. So couldn't use that. So going back to the U.S. Fire Administration, like, okay, maybe I can pull out this data and see what I can get from it. Well, every firefighter line of duty death has a little paragraph describing what happened, what took place, as well as, you know, information. Was it cardiac related? Was it traumatic? Their age, some demographic information for each one of these. So I'm like, okay, this is a great data set. So I can pull out vehicle crashes, did that. But then you've got, okay, were they just driving to a training event? Were they, you know, on duty and driving across town and got hit by a dump truck? That's not really relevant. So to get the most information, the what I needed, I had to jump into those little narratives, the couple sentence narratives, and get the details of each one of these fatalities, which was quite time consuming over a 20-year period. But it was also eye-opening and very sombering, sobering. It was to read through all these fatalities and the details of them. So I mentioned that in my dissertation that, you know, that I felt like that was sort of taking these fatalities to where they weren't in vain, to where, okay, let's use this to maybe prevent some fatalities in the future. So spent days, probably weeks, going through and reading each one of these and then coding. And that's just the term we use for putting a little piece of data for that fatality, that case, coding each one of these to what were they responding to. And some of these were kind of tough. They may not have said exactly what they were going to. Some of them said they were responding to an alarm. So I had to go back, get on Google News or go to the local newspapers and find a newspaper article that may have given more information to what they were actually responding to. And so that gave me quite a data set to, I'm like, okay, I can work with this. I think I can pull enough information out of here to draw some conclusions about what calls are more risky, if there are any, than others. And I had a few questions. I wanted to look at what type of call were they responding to when a fatal crash happened. I also looked at the number of crashes when returning from calls and see if there was any correlation there. I was kind of interested because, you know, sometimes you get an exciting call, your heart rate and your level of excitement stays up for quite some time.
Right.
I think your guest last episode, well, probably a couple episodes back when this releases, but she mentioned that, you know, it's 27 hours or something to actually de-stress.
Oh yeah. That's Minda O's. Yeah. Yeah. She was the kickoff in August, last month.
So, and I'm like, yeah, that sort of goes along with what I've seen also, to actually get it all out of your system, so to speak, to get all those stress hormones cleared from your system. So I was curious if that was going to affect anything when returning from calls. So that was my research question that I jumped into. I realized that there was enough data there. I'm like, okay, I think I can make some correlations here. So I jumped in and started gathering data. And that was sort of what finally brought it all together. When I realized that there is data available, it's never been used in this way. So maybe I can come up with a new idea on, or a new way to use this data to maybe draw some conclusions. So that was what ultimately led me to my dissertation topic.
I want to ask let's see if I can remember it. When you were considering this, did you also factor in seatbelts?
I did. And yeah, that's a good question, because if I've got this big data set and I'm already jumping into gathering this much data and there's already quite a bit there, why not go ahead and code some other things? So I did try to do that. There was surprisingly not as much as you would think on seatbelt use. Some of them just didn't mention it. Some of them sort of alluded to they might have been. And it got me thinking, you know, I started out as a volunteer in a small town. We knew all the handful of deputies. You know, if you're doing that report and you knew that firefighter, could it benefit the family? If I was a law enforcement officer, it's like, could it benefit the family insurance wise to, and I'm not pointing fingers and claiming insurance fraud, but if I just left that information out, whether they were wearing their seatbelt or not. And I don't know. I don't know if that was the cause of, but there was quite a few that it was not disclosed and I could not find that anywhere, whether they were or they weren't.
Well, however, sadly, we do know that firefighters do not like putting on a seatbelt.
Right.
Even in our new larger cabs. I mean, my day, our department was transitioning from riding the tailboard. When I started in October 1977, we still rode the tailboard, and then going to an inner seat, but it wasn't an enclosed cab. Right. But those were really tight as well.
Right.
When I moved up to upstate New York, their apparatus was a little bit newer, a little bit wider, so they did have seatbelts in those, and it was a termination level offense if you didn't wear your seatbelt.
I will say that seatbelt use has increased over the 20-year period that I did notice that trend.
That's good.
Yeah, it seemed to be, but you're also looking at, I was only looking at fatal cases. So
right.
Overall though, I do think that has improved drastically. I think our culture in the fire service of safety has improved in that arena, that it's commonplace. And you've got things like, you know, the vehicle data recorders that are tracking that. So you can't hide from it anymore. Right. I mean, it knows whether you're wearing it or not, whether there's a butt sitting in that seat. So yeah, it's kind of hard to hide, but, and I still see it, you know, still responding to calls that new guys jump in the back and they're so excited. If it's anything that's going to require an SCBA, they still think that that's the priority. So what we've done in our training program is, okay, you go through firefighter one, you learn, you know, how to put on your SCBA a couple different ways, over the head, lay on the floor, you practice it for time, laying on the floor. It's like, okay, now let's get in the truck and do this for real. Put your seatbelt on first and watch them get tangled up, and then watch them do it a couple more times and figure out, okay, if I just modify it a couple ways, it's really not that big of a deal to put an SCBA on in the seat with a seatbelt on. And I had to do the same thing. I mean, I one time thought fire trucks don't crash. You know, I got to get this pack on. Seatbelt's just going to slow me down, right? And it's nonsense. If you just practice it a couple times, it's no big deal to put your pack on with the seatbelt on.
Yeah, so we play a PSA in every podcast, one of two, that talks about firefighters and seatbelts, because we, you know, part of our main body of our job here is what we call is education in the fire service. And, you know, for us, a lot of the PSAs we put on are just aimed at our brothers and sisters in either fire service or brothers and sisters in, as first responders, of how to keep ourselves healthier and safer.
Yeah. And that's the great PSA, probably one of the best ones you can do. I mean, we get all wound up with, you know, ticks and pass devices and all the, you know, the emergency buttons on our radios and drag devices in our gear. But if we have to distill it down to one safety device that has saved more firefighters' lives than any other one, that's going to be seatbelts. And that's nothing new. You don't need anything. I mean, it's just keep your body in that vehicle. You're more likely to survive a crash.
Right.
It's that simple. So it's just changing habits, you know, is tough. Changing culture.
Well, it is. And especially with firefighters, because the two things we hate the most are status quo and change.
Change. Yep. Yeah. So that actually might be a good place to pause, building up to research questions. And then we can talk about some of my findings.
All right. That'll be great. All right. So folks, we're going to take a break here. And Dusty, or Dr. Dustin Lambert, will be back in just a few moments after a few words. So we'll be right back right after these words. And we always say to you, please stay tuned. The tone sounds and the dispatcher announces, stations 14 and 16, working residential structure. And that was all you needed to hear. You jump up from your chair, head to the engine, and climb into the jump seat. As the cue screams, you take stock of your PPE. Bunker pants, check. Turnout coat, check. Hood, check. Gloves, check. Escape line, check. SCBA strapped on, you're ready. Upon arrival, you jump off the apparatus, grab the loops of the Red Cross lei, and head for the open front door, where smoke is pouring out. You make sure your buddy is behind you. Crouch low and make your way inside, your trusty SCBA mask hanging on your tool belt. What? Stop everything! What the hell are you thinking? You see, it's a working room and contents fire, and the smoke is banking down almost to the floor. Who do you think you are, Superman? One breath of that crap and the smoke will damage you in some way, guaranteed. All the soot, carbon, carcinogens, and other outgassing materials will enter your body through the pores on your unprotected face. Don't be the domino, the first person down, that forces everyone else to change their task to take care of you. Always remember, face peace on. You have comrades depending on you and a family to go to. Face peace on.
It just slows me down.
It's too hard to do it and put my gear on.
I'm not comfortable.
I'm a big guy. I can't do it.
I'm just not comfortable wearing it.
You gotta be kidding me. Real firefighters don't need them.
Come on. There's no way I can wear my SCBA and my seatbelt at the same time.
Yes, we've heard all the excuses, but we can think of at least one good reason why you should buckle up. Can't you? Be a hero to those who mean the most to you. Buckle up. A message from the National Fallen Firefighters Foundation.
You show up for your shift, but you're not feeling 100%. You greet your colleagues with a smile, but just can't put your finger on it. I'll shake it off in an hour, you think to yourself. You take a couple of nothing runs, but you're still not feeling any better when you get back to the barn. You throw some cold water on your face and think, yeah, that's more like it, and you head back to the day room. With training scheduled for after lunch, you make yourself comfortable in one of the recliners, but as you sit there, you feel ill. You start to sweat, and you feel nauseous. There's a pain in your left arm that you've never had before. Hey, guys, you call out. I'm not feeling well. And your voice trails, your eyes close, and the darkness surrounds you. More firefighters die from cardiovascular health issues than any other reason. Don't let self-pride get in the way of taking care of yourself. See your doctor on a regular basis, and be sure to advise him or her that you're a firefighter. Don't be a statistic. Be a healthy firefighter with a long career. For more information, visit the IAFF, NVFC, or IAFC SHS websites.
Hello and welcome back to this episode of Five Alum Task Force. I'm your host, Steve Green, and my guest today is Dr. Dustin Lambert. We call him Dusty. He is a firefighter with over 20 years, probably more, 20 years experience in the West Virginia Career Department. And we are talking about a topic that we don't like talking about. But when I connected with him, I knew that this topic is something that we had to address, because from the very beginning, this podcast has been about education. And you know that when we do our little PSA for other firefighting podcasts, what? You promote other podcasts? Yeah, what do you think? I think I'm the only firefighting podcast out there. There are a gazillion of them, and some of them are terrific. But we always say at the very end of that listing, which we update on a frequent basis, is to be a great firefighter, you always have to be willing to learn. And Dusty is one of the epitomes of what that sentence means. He's a firefighter. He had 20 years. He didn't have to go and get a PhD. He didn't even have to go get a master's. He had a career. He enjoyed it. But he was looking for more about the career and from the career. And he dedicated himself to taking the additional coursework and putting in the time, effort, and money to earn both his master's and PhD. Why? To help us, to help every other firefighter who may listen to this podcast, watch it on YouTube, tell others about it, or learn about it in courses around the area, EVOC courses for drivers of emergency vehicles, because we get our news blasts every weekday, most of us, and all too often we see that brothers or sisters were injured and or lost their lives in a vehicular crash while responding to or coming from a call. And Dusty said, you know what? This needs to change. We've changed our behavior regarding firefighter cancer. We're changing our behavior about the Firefighter Behavioral Health Initiative. Why the hell can't we change our behavior and know that, yes, we must expedite our arrival on an emergency call, but not at the cost of danger to the firefighters on board the apparatus and the civilians that we pass on the way to the call? And that's why Dusty has done what he has done, and that's why I brought him onto the show. So, Dusty, let's talk about some of the pertinent facts that you've found in your research how they impact, pardon the pun, I didn't mean to say it that way, but how they impact us doing our job, either responding to the call or coming back to the barn after the call is done.
Yeah, right. So I sort of led you along the journey of what got me up to my research question. So when you distill down to what you're going to research, you have to come up with some research questions. What are you wanting to answer with this? So I determined that I had enough data out there to answer, I believed, these questions. So I wanted to know if are fatal emergency vehicle crashes amongst responding firefighters evenly distributed across all types of incidents that they're responding to? So, you know, if there was no discrepancy between, if there was no effect from the dispatch, then you would expect those crashes to be pretty evenly distributed, accounting for how many responses to each call you go to, if it's weighted. And when weighted for those exposures, which incidents have the highest fatal crash rate of firefighters while responding? And I hypothesized that, I sort of alluded to it earlier, that fires and entrapments, those type of incidents, would be the highest type of crashes. And I had to control for a couple things. So I mentioned that I had gone through 20 years of data and pulled out, you know, all the crashes while responding to emergencies. But when I get those numbers, that's not the full picture. You've got to account for how many of each type of call do you respond to every year. So, you know, if 60 to 70% of your calls are medical calls, which they pretty much are nationwide now,
right?
You would expect 60 or 70% of the crashes to be going to medical calls, right? Assuming that there is no risk difference between those. So I had to account for that somehow, which that became a little bit of a challenge, but figured it out. So let me flip up here to my notes, make sure I don't say anything wrong. So most of your listeners will be familiar with the NFERS reporting system. That was a great source for determining the rates of responses to each type of call. So looking at the rates of responses to fires versus false alarms versus car crashes, vehicle crashes. So results, I had 156 total fatalities in vehicles of firefighters while either responding to an emergency or returning from an emergency. Only 12 of those were while returning. So 92% were during response, probably not surprising. So overwhelmingly more dangerous to have, or more likely to have, a fatal crash while responding to an emergency. That had been shown before, but I was able to reiterate that a little bit with my research. So that showed 144 firefighter fatalities while responding to calls. So 80 of those were while responding to fires. That's over 55% while responding to some type of fire. EMS incidents made up 53. Now, under EMS incidents, I use the same coding system as what NFERS does. So you've got rescue, which is vehicle crashes. The majority of those were vehicle crashes. And since we're doing video, let me see here if I can get this little chart pulled up here. Still work so hard on it. There we go. So the majority of those were responding to fires. So that seemed to be supporting what I sort of thought would be the case. This is not factoring in a couple things. How many responses to each one of these were there nationwide? What's your normal average of statistics? And then there was something else that, just looking at this, many might not think about. How many fire apparatus will typically respond to a medical call? At least in my department, you're going to get whatever the closest engine company is, or maybe an SUV, depending on what station it is, if they have that. So usually one, maybe two, just for a normal medical call. But how many apparatus respond to a fire? For us, 5, 6, you know, maybe more, depending on where you're at. So I had to get those to really give us a solid number there, because if you've got 5 times more vehicles responding to a fire than you do all these others, then of course you're going to have more crashes responding to fires, right? That sure would perfectly explain this. So I had to take that into consideration. So whenever I pulled out the average responses, we had 60% was rescue and EMS related. Again, that's no surprise. Most of our departments will run the majority of those. The smells and bells and EMS calls is what makes up a lot of it. So fires was less than 8%, 7.5% of calls were fire related. So if we flip back over and thought of that, okay, fires are only making 7%, 7.5% of our calls, but are accounting for over half of our fatal crashes during response. Okay, that's a problem. Now we factor in how many apparatus were responding to each one. So I was able to, again, pull those from the NFERS data. And on average nationwide, when it's a fire type of incident, we have about 3.3 apparatus responding to fires in general. Similar for overpressure, makes sense because those are probably often dispatched as a fire or explosion. EMS calls, 1.5 apparatus, so way less there. So now we got to factor all this in together. And that's where the magic of statistics comes into play, which I had to learn a lot about epidemiology, which was not my area of expertise, but it was interesting to learn that. Okay, so what we're calling exposure is accounting for the number of apparatus responding and the percentage of call volume that does present. So false alarms account for around less than 13. Rescue and EMS calls account for 52% or so, and fires account for about 12% of our response exposure. So that's, again, accounting your total apparatus and total call volume. So when you account for that, you've got less than 12% of the exposure is accounting for still about 56% of the crashes. So that right there is a blaring issue, obviously. And then when you look into the vehicle crashes or the rescues, we're seeing the same trend. Only about 11% of our total responses or exposures, and accounting for over 25%, 26% of our fatal crashes. Of the fire type of calls, structure fires are by far the worst, accounting for only about 7% of our responses. And as far as the fatal crashes, it's over a third of the fatal crashes. So that right there is the pinnacle of the issue.
Sure.
That is insanely disproportionate. So back to that nerdy statistics stuff is, you come up with what's called a relative risk or a risk ratio. Now this number is used often in looking at diseases. So if you've got group A, group E, this one takes a medication or smokes or whatever that is, and this one doesn't, and you want to compare and see how much more risk does this group have than this one, you come up with a risk ratio. If you get a one for that, then it means there's really no risk, no matter which path you follow, no matter what you do. Anything over one is, hey, we need to be looking here because there is a little bit of increased risk. Anything under one is actually safer to do that. So keeping that in mind, when, you know, cancer researchers see 1.5 or 1.8, that's setting off alarm bells for them that, hey, there's a problem with whatever this chemical is or whatever that exposure is. Well, using those same formulas, when you're responding to fires, you get a relative risk of 9.3. Wow. Compared to all of the type. Yeah. So that was huge. I like to use that analogy to put it in perspective. Structure fires are 7.1. Other fires still 5.1. And again, one is the threshold. Anything over one and usually under two even throws up some alarm bells. So that was concerning whenever I saw that, but that was my ultimate findings of that increase in risk. And you get down into like the service calls, the false alarms, and they are, you know, 0.1, 0.2, so they're almost non-existent. Right. So that, again, no surprise, right? How much urgency do we have to go pump out a flooded basement? Not much. So we're not having like idiots to go cut up a down tree. We're not forgetting to put our seatbelt on whenever we're going to go check on some downed power lines. But we are doing all those things whenever we hear the word fire or whenever we hear the word entrapment. And ultimately that's leading to fatalities of firefighters, but also fatalities of civilians. Yeah.
Right. And we just saw a story in the last couple of weeks where a firefighter was held responsible for his engine struck and killed another car, and he was found at fault.
Yeah.
They didn't have all the, you know, all the details there, but listen, we don't want to see this. We don't want anybody to be at fault. We don't want anybody to get hurt, but we have to change. And when you hear these statistics, it should give you a shudder, because, you know, you hear on this podcast and many other podcasts, the Firefighter Cancer Initiative and Behavioral Health Initiative. And those are imperative for us. And they're making great headway. We're doing good with both of them. But if we can't, we have very difficult jobs that we do. We do things that we don't want anybody else to have to do or to have to see. That's the given. And we know that. But we also have to realize that we have to be responsible in our responses. And, you know, these statistics that you've provided here, the tremendous difference, 700% differences of how likely it is that these accidents are going to occur when we let our mind drive instead of we let our heart drive instead of our mind. And when the heart drives, you're going to blow every red light, every stop sign. You're going to get there because that's what your heart's telling you to do. You know what? You also fell in love when you were 12 years old and that girl didn't care about you. So you have to realize that sometimes that heart is not always going to be the best guidance. And there are times where your brain will pull on the rein, say, whoa, stop, slow down. Yeah, I know this is important to me too, but we're not going to help anybody if we don't get there.
Right. Yeah, it's that lizard brain taking over, your emotional brain, and it's canceling out your logical brain. And that's kind of what's scary about this is most drivers don't realize it. They don't know that they're being affected by their excitement level or, you know, the type of dispatch. You don't realize it. Kind of like being drunk. You know, after a few drinks, you don't think you're impaired and you jump in a vehicle. You don't realize that that impairment is happening. You don't realize that you're getting tunnel vision, that you're going 10 miles an hour faster than you typically would going to any other call type. You don't realize it. And that's probably, if I could, you know, get that message out right there to incorporate that into EVOC training, is you don't realize you are hindered whenever you are by your emotional state.
Right.
Yeah, that's probably the big takeaway from it.
I've always worn my emotions on my sleeve, unfortunately. But so it is what it is. And I used to think that, you know, my wife and my grown daughters say, oh, Dad, you know, that was cute. You're crying, tearing up a little bit for that. But watching a couple of TV shows about the fire service, especially the one I got to give Dick Wolf kudos, because though I didn't like his other stuff, he did a good job with LA County Fire and Rescue. And to see these big, burly LA County firefighters crying on the screen as they talk about family, as they talk about calls and stuff like that, it shows that we are human. We're not Superman. We're not Superwoman. We're humans who feel that we want to serve our communities. That's who we are. We're important to families. It's important to our communities to serve them. But you have to serve them correctly and safely, because the last thing you want to do is hurt them when you're trying to go to help somebody.
Yeah. I just was talking to a guy on my shift the other day about this, just sort of one of those random late night, deep philosophical conversations that I had this epiphany. I was like, we aren't first responders. We're last responders. After everything else has failed, that's when we get called. You know, after your building code, electrical standards, your smoke alarms, your seat belts, all the other safety features that's in the normal people's lives, after that has failed, the traffic laws, after all that's failed, then we get called to maybe try to help
clean up the
to
mess.
The best of our knowledge. Yeah. Right. So we're not really first. All that other stuff really comes first and works most of the time. But when that has failed, then we get called. So we never really think of it that way, but you know, that's ultimately what we are, is when all else has failed. So we don't think of it that way.
Well, I cried with my first unsuccessful CPR. And I cried with my first successful CPR. there was just nothing like bringing this person back and bringing him viable to the hospital.
Yeah.
And, you know, I got back, you know, did everything professionally, got back in the rig and wept like a baby, because I and my partner, we brought somebody who was dead back to life.
Right.
And, you know, as a man of faith, you know, that's God's job, not mine. But
right.
I was sent there. My life was turned upside down by going to a community I didn't plan on going to, and into a field I wasn't planning to go into. But it brought me there, and it brought me into the fire service and EMS. And I will never regret that decision at all. But I also learned, especially in that first station, with the chief, the captain, and one of the caretakers became a dear friend and was a mentor for me and my buddy, is that there's a right way of being a firefighter and there's a wrong way of being a firefighter. And we're only going to teach you the right way of being a firefighter. We will never teach you the wrong way to be a firefighter. You may choose the wrong path once in a while, but we're teaching you the right way. So that's what's important. And they, you know, they stressed all the safety things that we had back in the 70s and up through the mid 80s. And that was how I learned it. It was ingrained in me as being a rookie who only knew how to use hand tools, couldn't even change the spark plugs in my own car, and couldn't even change my oil. But one of these guys took the time to even show me that stuff, those little life lessons. Yeah, yeah. Sure. Did he tell me to undo the valve, the bolt on the oil tank, and didn't warn me to move my head out of the way, and I got a face full of oil. Yeah, but I laughed my ass off.
Yeah,
because he did it to teach me.
Some lessons have to be learned; they can't be taught.
Exactly. And so, if we are so dedicated to saving lives and property, whether we're firefighters, EMS, or law enforcement, if we're so aimed, and that's what our heart is telling us we want to do with our lives, why do we let ourselves do the wrong things responding to these calls, responding back? If you don't have another call after you finish a call, you don't have to rush back. You want to expedite your return so that you can get clean, deconned and stuff like that, and clean the grid, change clothes, take your shower within an hour. Yeah. But unless you dispatch another call, you don't have to rush back to the barn. And when you're going there, going to your call, what you've heard so far just in this podcast should be enough to say to you and to tell you and to teach you that you don't have to go to the call that way either. You can go there, you can expedite it, but you do it safely and conscientiously. Not as a second thought. It has to be your primary thought. I got to drive this apparatus as quickly but as safely as I can to get everybody there safe and sound so we can do what we have to do. And if you don't have that philosophy in your head as a driver on any type of fire apparatus or an ambulance or a police car, then don't drive. Do something else.
Yeah.
Doesn't mean you're a bad person.
Right.
It just means do something else.
I mentioned earlier about aeromedical, the pilot not knowing what they're responding to. And I realized that would be a hugely unpopular thing to have dispatchers that just say engine one respond to 123 Main Street, period. You know, we want to know as much information as we can up front. But you know, as a driver, you can say to yourself, okay, yep, that sounds like it might be bad. Now let's block that out. Let's put that on pause, put it on the shelf, forget that that's happening. And now I'm going to focus on driving safely, just like I would for to any other type of call. I'm going to be cautious, you know, block that out. And then I can bring that back in, that information back into my head once I get to the call, which is hard to do. But, you know, if you start practicing that, then it kind of puts you back. It recenters right. you back at the task at hand.
Right. So, and you got to keep your sit. And, you know, we've talked about this on this show numerous times. We've had Dr. Rich Gasaway on here,
yeah.
who is our expert in situational awareness. And it's not just when we're doing our 360. It's not when we're just using the flare. When you are a driver, you must keep your situational awareness. That's yeah. it. You don't have a choice. That yeah. we do it when we drive a car. Or we're supposed to be doing it when we drive our cars.
Yeah, it is 100%. It's situation awareness, and it's an outside influence of your situation awareness. Rich, actually, he proofread my dissertation before I submit it. So he's a good guy.
Great guy. And
he offered, and I took him up on that, and out of the blue, met him at FDIC, and he offered, and followed through.
He did one of our webinars on situational awareness, and he was phenomenal.
Yeah.
And, you know, again, one of those great teachers, because he doesn't berate you. He teaches you.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, that's the kind of teacher my mentor was to me, not even when I was a kid. He was teaching me the right way, not to punish me, not to push me beyond my limits, just to teach me what I needed to know and so I could do it to the best of my ability.
Yeah.
And that's what Dr. Gasaway does.
Yeah.
He doesn't, you know, castigate you. He doesn't call you names. He just says, look, you want to do this job, you want to do it safely, this is what you have to do.
Yeah, here's the facts. Right. So there was a few sort of auxiliary findings that I did have to mention here too, before I forget, I had mentioned that when I was going through all these fatality cases, I was going to code some extra additional information. And one of those was the career status, were they career or volunteer? And again, not bashing on anybody, I've done both. I started out as a volunteer in my little hometown for 3 years, and still, you know, go back there and visit often. But 88% of these fatal crashes involved volunteers, compared to 11% were on the career side. And that's a
compelling
crazy statistic. 66% of the country's volunteers, so the majority of the country's firefighters are volunteer, but almost 70% of the responses are by the career departments. So again, it's back to that exposure. And, you know, thinking back, you do get desensitized when you run more calls and you get less excited. And whenever I was a volunteer and we had 300 calls a year, yeah, you would get excited to go help somebody. And, you know, you're in your small towns, there's a good chance you know them, you know, it's right. one of your neighbors. So I think that sense of urgency might be worse on the volunteer side for a myriad of reasons. I'm just speculating at that point, but that was an interesting finding. So your volunteer listeners, you are at higher risk of having a fatal crash than on the career side, and you are at higher risk of having a fatal crash while responding to a fire than all other types. So that's especially true for that portion of your listener base. And along the same lines, the majority of the vehicles were personal vehicles, which was interesting to me, because FEMA and U.S. Fire Administration has focused in the last 10, 15, 20 years almost on tankers, tenders, if you're in the West, right. but water tankers, which makes sense. They are especially heavy fire 3, trucks.
3,000, you know, 3,000. Yeah,
yeah, you're looking at a huge amount of weight. They're top heavy. Design has improved on them, and they have been especially fatal, but they aren't as fatal as what personal vehicle crashes are. So that was an interesting sort of side finding that I found. When you're by yourself, you know, at home, and your pager goes off and you need to respond to the station, there's nobody in the right seat saying, hey, what's your speed? Let's slow down a little bit, right? You don't have that officer over there. to give you some more input, you're getting the tunnel vision, you get excited, and that's increasing your risk. So that's a good takeaway for
it is. I still use it when my wife drives. If she's in the passenger seat of the car, I will always tell her to make sure you tell me clear right if I'm making a left turn for that. And vice versa, if she's driving and I'm in the passenger seat, and I tell you don't move until I tell you you're clear on the right side.
Yeah.
And my buddy I told you about, who's the helicopter pilot, when we're together, just going up, driving to lunch, we'll just do the same thing. It just became part. We went on a lot of calls together in that department. And it just became how we operated. And
yeah, it's crew resource management. Before you even knew that there was a name for it, probably you were doing it.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and you mentioned about in that last piece about risk reduction. And as of maybe the last 8 to 10 years, we've done a lot of focus on community risk reduction, which is great.
Right.
Clearing lots from flammable stuff and things like that. But you have to look when you're driving an apparatus or you're driving a personal car to the station to answer an alarm. You have to realize and make that conscientious effort for risk reduction when you're driving.
Yeah, that's true.
This isn't community risk reduction. This is arrival and getting back home.
Personal risk reduction. Yeah.
Right. You want to get to the scene so you can do your job, and you want to get everybody safely back so you can clean up, rest up, and wait for the next bells.
Yeah.
But you have to be able to survive each call to be able to do that.
Yeah. And again, I think that a lot of times we don't even realize that we're being affected. I know back the episode with Responder Safety Institute, and I forget who the guests were, but it's been back.
Oh, Jack and
springtime.
Yeah, Jack and Todd. Yeah, Jack and Todd.
They talked about the D's, you know, the drivers.
Yes, I have my D driver poster right there. Drunk, drugged, drowsy, distracted, disgruntled, disturbed, disrespectful, drag racers, driverless, dangerous, and in even some cases, dead
drunk. Yeah, and I would argue that we are up to five of those oftentimes whenever we're responding to calls. I mean, drowsy is not uncommon for middle night calls, but the disgruntled, disturbed, distracted, and drag racing. We aren't actually drag racing, but we're drag racing ourselves in our mind to get there, that sense of urgency.
Or the other station in the city, we're drag racing.
Yeah.
Or the next community coming in with mutual aid, we want to get there first, right?
Yeah, which is stupid.
I mean, this is like Goonies stuff in the movie with the kids. I mean, we don't do this as adults. We're as lifesavers. We shouldn't be doing this. That's something you play as a kid. You can't hold those same values as an adult when you're driving a 3-ton apparatus. We're carrying either 3,000 gallons of water or 750 gallons of water, because that's going to change your whole driving and braking capabilities.
Right. Yeah. And there was actually a famous crash in Virginia, and I can't remember the town right offhand, but it was in the 80s that exact thing happened, which is where the term siren side originally came from. But there was, you know, Department A, Department B were dispatched to a vehicle fire. Department B, who it wasn't their first due, actually got there first. Engine from Department A missed the turnoff, so they were already behind the whole curve there, had to turn around. So, you know, they were all flustered, really trying to get there, but they knew they were running behind. Just a series of events, and drove right in front of an Amtrak train and derailed it. So what went from a single, you know, alarm, simple car fire, 500 gallons of water, derailed a train, killed firefighters, injured dozens of people on the train, just turned into a small catastrophe. All because of that sense of urgency. And that's the anecdote I always like to use, because man, that's what could happen. It's scary.
Yeah. We have a lot of responsibility as firefighters, and it's not just the team, it's individually as well. And we've seen it. If you read any of Kurt Verone's articles in Firehouse,
Oh yeah.
You know, in Kurt speaks from his experience both as a firefighter and as an attorney.
Yeah.
And, you know, there are some things that we just cannot, that we just can't be protected from if we choose to take the wrong path and the wrong action. And you can't just say, well, I was a firefighter responding to a call, because that's not an excuse.
Yeah. No, and we even have the benefit of the doubt, I think, a lot of times, sadly. Yeah. I don't know that we should, but, you know, people be like, oh, well, this car didn't yield. It's like, yeah, they didn't yield, but did they even have time to yield? Did they even realize that there was a, you know, a fire or ambulance or police car that was about to blow through that red light? If they would have saw them, yeah, they probably would have yielded. But really, can you even put any blame at all on that poor old lady who, you know, didn't see them coming?
Yeah.
There's also a protective factor of having lights and sirens on for us driving like idiots. You know, that does get people's attention. If you were to drive that way without lights and sirens, obviously you would crash way more. So having those is almost suppressing how many crashes we probably would have, which is scary.
Yeah, there's no doubt about it. And even with the forthcoming that's already out there a little bit, some of the technology now that can notify drivers right in their cars on their infotainment systems that there is some sort of an emergency ahead, and to start moving over. Our friends from HazAlert have the Safety Cloud. They do it, and there are some other companies out there, and the departments are buying into this because, you know what, they can't afford to lose a $3 million tiller truck because somebody wasn't paying attention and drove through the safety zone and blew it off, and it knocked four firefighters, took them out of active service for almost a year because you were inebriated or something like that.
Yeah, so, which is a great solution. I mean, that's an engineering solution, which is, you know, your first go-to for any safety problem.
Exactly.
You want to engineer the problem out. And that's great to see that. But then on we're not going to eliminate the driver. We unfortunately can't eliminate that. So I always tell new firefighters, you know, yeah, you've got this big, brightly colored fire apparatus with the brightest LEDs imaginable now, you know, all the technology, loud sirens. We've got Opticom systems to change stoplights in our favor. You know, the HazAlert, there's a lot of things out there to alert other drivers. Okay, now forget that. Drive like you're invisible. Exactly. And if you drive like you're invisible, assume that nobody sees you, you'll be doing okay. You know, because you're going to approach intersections assuming, oh, I'm invisible. That car's probably going to pull out in front of me. Or if I continue through this intersection, they're just going to keep driving. So assume that you're invisible. And if you drive like you're invisible, you're almost always going to get there safely.
Let me ask you a question. And this goes all the way back to the beginning of the discussion when we said driving under the influence of dispatch. I think it's important that we may have, maybe me more than you, I may have kind of, and I didn't mean to infer that a lot of these problems that we've been discussing in this episode are because of the dispatchers. That's not what we're saying.
Right.
We're saying that we get the dispatch in our head.
Right.
And that takes us over.
Yes. Spot on. And maybe that I never even considered that being taken that way. So that's a good clarification. I appreciate you pointed that out. Yeah. It's driving under the influence of what we imagine, what we're anticipating that scene being.
Right.
And that anticipation of that scene is perhaps driving us to mentally to be in a mindset of urgency that may or may not be justified. Oftentimes not, sadly. So it has nothing to do with the actual dispatcher telecommunicator. It has to do with the information we're receiving and what we were imagining.
Right. So how do we tie this up? Where do you think the next steps are that you'd like to see happen, even if they take your dissertation and turn it into an educational book that we give to every single driver in the department? You're going to be a driver. You're going to take these 3 weeks of training, and you got to master this book as well.
There's a lot more research, I think, that could be built off of this. I'm actually updating or eyeballing updating this next year with the newest, most recent couple years of data, although I've glanced at it and the trends aren't really changing, sadly. So I think that it's worthy of a paragraph or at least a few minutes of talking in an EVOC class on those external factors and really stressing that. And if people realize how much more risk certain call types are over others, then maybe I think that's the first step of knowing that, hey, okay, there's a lot of risk here. So when you hear that type of incident, you're thinking as a driver, you're thinking, oh, okay, I need to put a little bit of extra effort to make sure that I don't blow through a red light, or put a little bit of extra effort to make sure that all my passengers are seatbelted. Because whenever I hear that it's a fire and I'm amped up as a driver, everybody else in that vehicle is experiencing the same thing. So they're just as likely to not put their seatbelt on or, you know, take extra risks as well. So if you're behind that wheel, then it's ultimately your responsibility. So I think knowing that that risk exists, there are some techniques for dealing with acute stress, which is really interesting to me. If we could install blow and goes in fire apparatus to where, you know, you get a blow in it and it'll tell you how stressed you are, that'd be perfect. I don't think that's going to happen. Right. So that if, you know, you can't even take it out of park until you calm down a little bit. But the other option, you know, there's, if obviously your listeners like podcasts, but Huberman Lab, Andrew Huberman, is a neuroscientist, and he talks a lot about stress and managing acute stress. You can change your focus. So looking off into the distance, actually sort of broaden your horizon and literally bring your level of acute stress down. Eye movement, he talks a lot about that, left and right. There's also a lot of breath work, which sounds like some sort of woo-woo science made up, but it's not. It's been researched quite thoroughly now, with controlling your breathing, which isn't new. But when you get elevated, get stressed, your heart rate goes up, your respirations go up, you're releasing all these stress hormones, and you can't control your heart rate directly, but you can control it indirectly through your breathing. So if you can remind yourself when you're walking to the truck after hearing that dispatch and knowing that that dispatch information is going to, you know, ramp you up, start controlling your breathing. And what's called a physiological sigh, I think, is probably the most effective and interesting to me, because I've got a little 1-year-old boy who, when he starts crying, I notice he does this, and it is a thing. It's rapid inhales.
Yeah. My grandson does it too.
Yeah. And that we do that too. We can do that as an adult. It's a few rapid inhales followed by a long, slow exhale. And if you do that a few times, that is the quickest way to calm down your emotions. So it'll slow down your breathing, which in turn slows down your heart rate, which in turn tells your brain, hey, I'm de-stressing. And your brain says, oh, okay, well, I guess it's just a feedback loop that you're interrupting by doing that with that physiological sigh. And I think that was really some cool research that, yeah, that came out on that side.
That's very good. And it's something that can be easily done. Like you said, walking to the apparatus, or even if you're trotting to the apparatus, that doesn't mean you have to like that, but it means just do these short breaths in and take several of them and then let it flow out. Yeah. I do it with the kids I train for bar and bar mitzvah. When they get up onto the podium, I said, you know, when you're breathing at home, I want you to start taking some nice deep breaths in. Hold it for 3 seconds, then blow it out through your mouth, in through your nose and out through your mouth.
Yeah.
When you get up there Saturday morning, you're going to do the same thing. I'm going to say, you're going to lead us in this prayer, and you're going to take that breath, and you're going to exhale, and then you're going to go right into it. And I know it works for them. It works for me.
It does.
I use it for even with the back problems and the knee problems, stuff like that. I've used it there. So there's no doubt that, and by the way, if you know, you may be not thinking about it, folks, but when you take that nice, slow, deeper breath in, you're giving yourself more oxygen than you normally would get with your regular breathing. And so that more oxygen allows you to think more clearly. It doesn't go to your heart per se, that your heart's going to be faster. I got to help them more. No, it's going to your brain. It's going to tell you to bring yourself down a peg and continue on your objective, but do it in a, you know, calm fashion.
Yeah, and blow it off that CO2, same thing.
Yep, exactly.
Reduce your vasoconstriction in your brain, so you're getting better circulation. Yeah, it helps your cognition. So there's just a huge ripple effect from doing that. And you know, you've always got some drivers, some people who are more prone to this effect than others, I think. Some people who are more easily ramped up for certain call types. And when you have that happen and you see them, you know, amped up, they're the ones who are just grabbing their stuff. They're pulling up their pants with their suspenders still down around between their legs type of thing, you know, walking to the truck because, and you know, they're just so almost flustered. I'll try to crosswire them a little bit, you know, because they're so task saturated. You know, ask them something completely irrelevant to almost snap them out of it. You know, ask them something not relating to that, and to where they kind of have to stop and think about it. That can help sort of get them, sort of derail them off of that path that they're on.
Oh, that's for sure. My wife and I worked with mentally, mostly handicapped adolescents and young adults at a summer camp. And some of these kids, you know, fixate. And I would just do something else to break them off. And all of a sudden, it's a different, it was a different youngster, a different adolescent, because they were thinking, they weren't thinking about this, the same thing they always do and they're focusing on. I just broke that train of thought gently, but with something pleasant, and it worked. You know, it relaxes them a bit, because you're not allowing them to dwell on the things that bother them, but they don't vocalize.
Yeah,
they don't know how to vocalize it sometimes.
Great comparison, because when we get in that mind state, that fight or flight, we literally revert back to a very childlike emotional state, which, you know, when you're a kid, your emotions, you don't have control over your emotions yet. That's one of the things that differentiates adults from children, is you're being able to control your emotions better. And that's why kids get so upset oftentimes over what may seem like minuscule things. But when you get into that high emotional, high excitement state, you start thinking like a kid or like a child. You aren't real clear. So yeah, the same tools apply to derail that. So yeah, it's spot on.
That's great. Well, I don't know. I think we've started, we've opened the door a little bit to this. It's not a topic that I'm sure a lot of our brothers and sisters really want to hear. But I think you and I agree, and Dr. Gassaway probably, that this is an imperative that they need to hear.
Yeah.
Yeah. This has to be really come to the same level as we are with the behavioral health and the cancer initiatives. Yes. Because if we don't, with faster vehicles, more traffic clogs, you know, stuff like that, we're going to be ramping this up and not bringing this down.
Yeah.
Every loss of a firefighter, of a EMT and paramedic or a law enforcement officer is tragic. But when that loss could have been avoided by just good thinking, it's even more tragic. And it didn't have to happen. Now, no, we can't stop every single bad thing in life. We don't have that ability, that magic, the magic wand, whatever Harry Potter used. We don't have that. But we can, as we said before, risk reduction. And if you're a driver of an emergency vehicle, you better know when you get behind that wheel and buckle that seatbelt, it's time for risk reduction, not ramping it up.
Yeah. Well put. Yeah, that's
right. Well, Dustin, I can't thank you enough. I'm so glad that Nick put us together. And again, this is a topic that we've just touched on, but this is also the season that we're trying to really focus on key issues and not just entertainment. There are key issues still facing the fire service that we need to address. And this is not was, is absolutely one of them. This podcast by itself is not going to change a whole lot of people. But if you're a listener or a viewer, and you can take this to heart and maybe share it with somebody else, even if they don't want to watch it, teach them what you've learned from listening or watching this podcast with Dusty Lambert and what we've talked about today, because you could be that one who reaches out to one of your coworkers, and without even knowing you might be the one who might stop an unnecessary occurrence from happening just because you shared, hey, you know, I just listened to this podcast and there are a lot of problems with the way we drive, I guess, that I didn't know about. If you can start that discussion in the firehouse, that's a great first step.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right. That's got to be grassroots at that level of just somebody having the being brave enough to say, hey, slow down, or say, hey, I'm not moving this truck until you put your seatbelt on. Not being a jerk, but I'll wait. You know, well, nobody's house has ever burnt down because you took 3 seconds to put your seatbelt.
Exactly. Exactly. I hope that we'll be seeing you teach at conferences, national conferences and regional conferences, because this is probably one of the most important topics we can address today.
I'm flattered. I appreciate that. That means a whole lot coming from
you. I mean, there's no doubt. I guess, you know, sometimes I talk like I've been in the fire service all these years, but it's been a part of me all these years. You know, I only was able to serve for those 8, but it's always been a part of me. It's still how I define myself.
You're on the cutting edge with your guests. So, I mean, you're probably more current than most that are still in the fire service.
Well, I've just been blessed. I've been blessed to be able to get great guests. And I thank the good Lord above for every one of them, because everyone has taught me. Every one of them has said something that could be teaching our listeners and viewers if they want to hear it.
Yeah.
But, you know, oh, what do you mean? I can't drive fast. They don't want me to drive fast. I'll listen to the next one. I don't want to listen to this one.
Right. Yeah.
They're out there. We know that.
Yeah.
We know that. And we can't, you know, not everybody likes vanilla ice cream. Not everybody likes chocolate ice cream, but sometimes. So I'm glad that I was able to provide you and that you were willing to come on to give you the opportunity of sharing this in a really broad spectrum. Now, I'm sure you probably had more readers in your firehouse article than we'll get listeners or viewers of this, but that's okay, because as long as we keep the message going and keep the message out there, people are going to think about it.
Multiple formats is always a good thing. So
exactly.
Thanks a lot, Steve. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Really, Dusty, I really appreciate it. We put this together real fast, but I thank you so very much for making the time for it. It's such an important topic. Please keep us posted with how things are going. I probably will be interested in reaching out to you in the spring and have you back again for an update.
Perfect. I'd be happy to.
Yeah. And you can reach, you can find Dusty on social media. We'll put it in the show notes, but both his Twitter and Instagram handles is Firefighter Wisdom. And no, that's not an oxymoron. Okay. Firefighter Wisdom. And remember that, you know what? We do. We have a lot of wisdom that we use, but there's a lot we know we have it. We just don't use it. So hopefully when you think of looking him up at Firefighter Wisdom on Twitter or Instagram, you'll understand that he's trying to help us be a little better, be a little safer, and help save others as well. And that's what this podcast and his research, his dissertation is all about, is not to throw stones, not to let off steam, but to help us learn about some of our own foibles, because we do great work and we do pull off some miracles sometimes, thank goodness. But sometimes we also make mistakes, and some of them can be dire mistakes. But if you're just open to keep yourself mind open to learning and understanding and sharing, you don't have to be a certified teacher. You can share whatever you learn at a fire conference, on a podcast, on a TV show, whatever, you can share that with others. So our sincere thanks to Dr. Dustin Lambert for joining us today. We will be back next week with another episode. If you're watching the video, this is going to conclude the video. If you're listening to the audio, well, you know that we'll take a little break here and we'll be back with a few more items right after this. But to all of you, thank you very much for tuning in. It's always a pleasure to be with you and to have you with us. Dusty, thank you again. Great, great work that you've done in researching this very important issue. May you always have the wind on your tail and safe skies.
Thanks, Steve.
Thanks. You take care. Folks, that's it for the video. Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you again next week. Make sure you take care of each other, and let's make sure everyone goes home. Bye-bye now.
You're listening to Five Alarm Task Force.
Remember when you were a young boy or girl and someone bullied or teased you? Where do you most often turn? Like many of us, you turn to your family. If you're a first responder, you probably no longer worry about those childhood problems. But there are plenty more that can affect us. Lack of sleep, the tragedy and horror we often see, even life's everyday stumbling blocks, like family illness, money, job problems, and more. So where do you turn now? Your gut reaction might be to keep it to yourself and not tell anyone about the hell you're going through. However, that's not going to help you or anyone else. Instead, you could start with your second family, someone you work with at the firehouse, on the ambulance, or at the station. You spend a lot of time with them, and most of them understand many of the problems you're dealing with. Reach out to a coworker or an officer you trust. Speak to clergy at your house of worship, or contact your SISM team. Don't keep it inside, gnawing away at you. That's not good for you or anyone around you. Know that there are people who stand ready to listen to you and help you without passing judgment. Remember, to carry out your oath to protect life and property, the first life you have to care for is your own. Brought to you by Five Alarm Task Force, along with the Critical Incident Stress Management Team in your area, close by and confidential.
Drinking and driving is a serious problem that threatens everyone on the road. About 112 million times a year, U.S. adults drink too much and get behind the wheel. The number of drinking and driving episodes has been decreasing, but the danger is still very real. Crashes involving alcohol-impaired drivers kill nearly 11,000 people each year. If you're drinking, designate a non-drinking driver before you start, call a cab, or get a ride home. Never let your friends drink and drive. Even if you don't drink and drive, always wear your seatbelt and encourage everyone else in the car to buckle up too. Seatbelts reduce the risk of serious injuries and death in a crash by 50%. Remember, driving drunk is never okay. Choose not to drink and drive and help others to do the same. To learn more, visit www.cdc.gov/vital signs. This message brought to you by the Center for Disease Control and Five Alarm Task Force. Hi, this is Steve. We really hope that you enjoyed our guest today, Captain Dustin Lambert, as we talked about driving under the influence of dispatch. But many of us didn't even need to hear this podcast to know about what we were speaking, because I've seen it since I got in almost 50 years ago. In North Carolina, when I first joined, they used to kind of make fun of me a little bit because I was the quote-unquote city boy coming down to Guilford County, North Carolina. And after getting my first little teardrop red light that the state allowed us to get, I kind of got eat up, as the phrase was used down there, eat up with the concept. And probably within 6 weeks, I had a 4-bulb sealed beam on the roof of my car. I had lollipops in the dash, in the front grill, and two lollipops in the back of the back window as well. So I drove around that way for about 15, 18 months and thought it was super cool. However, I was driving under the influence of the dispatch. Depending on the level of the call would be how fast I'd drive to get to the station. Now, if I was at our apartment, I was only a third of a mile from the firehouse, so that part was easy. But if I was at work, which I could only leave as long as I wasn't teaching a student privately, I was not in a meeting, and it had to be a significant call level, I was about a mile and a half, 2 miles away. So I would drive a little bit more aggressively. I was wrong. It really was, and it is still today. Listen, we may be firefighters, law enforcement officers, EMS workers, but the fact is we're still human and we still have human reactions. As Dusty spoke about today, we often allow those emotions when we get in that driver's seat. We let those emotions sometimes get the better of us. Now, to become a driver in most departments, even volunteer and part pay, you have to have a certain amount of time under your belt as a firefighter. You have to know your apparatus very well, and you have to go through the testing. Perhaps your department requires an EVOC class for you, which is, or I would recommend, would always be the best bet if you're going to drive an apparatus, no matter if it's career, volunteer, part pay, etc. You need to be familiar with that apparatus, and you just can't go from one of the jump seats pulling line to behind the driver's wheel and think you know everything about driving that vehicle. While the vehicles and their safety components are much more advanced than in my day, the basics were still there. You can't blow a red light without slowing down and checking first. One of the great things we had in our department, and I think it was automatically carried over into EMS when I worked with them as well, is that whoever was in the right seat had to check that right direction of travel so that there were no oncoming cars and that they could tell the driver, clear on the right. And to tell you the truth, here we are in 2023. I still do that with my wife and my grown daughters when they're in the car with me and I'm driving, or they're in the car and they're driving. I still will watch that side or request it from who's ever on the right seat in my car to make sure I'm clear right. We've seen, unfortunately, in the last couple of years, some serious traffic accidents of responding apparatus with civilian cars or commercial vehicles. Now, sometimes they just cannot be prevented. It just happens. And we know that's true as well. But it's incumbent upon us as firefighters, as the drivers of these vehicles, to be responsible. Does it mean that you're going to have to try to calm down the beating of that heart when you've heard that there's a pediatric situation involved, or it's a large working big box fire and you want to get there? But the fact is you want to get there safely. And you don't want anybody else to be injured while you respond. Now, whether you drive your own car to the station, if you're a part pay or a volunteer, you have to operate under those very same rules. Those lights on your car don't give you the right to blow stop signs, blow intersection lights, traffic lights, etc. You have to drive as carefully at the slightly elevated speed than you would driving your family, driving your family to the movies or to the mall or to school. It is incumbent upon us as lifesavers to save lives wherever we can. And that doesn't always mean making a good grab. It means being a responsible driver, engineer, or specialist, whatever your title is. You have to be always attentive. And don't let the pounding of your heart and the pressing of your brain telling you it's a dangerous call. We got to get there. We got to get there. You do have to get there, but you have to do it safely. Remember, our job is saving lives, not injuring or worse, other people. And that's my view. If you like a good firefighting conference where you can learn, you can share, you can teach, and you can enjoy, well, the North Florida Fire Expo is the place to be. It is an affordable, unapologetically blue-collar fire conference for firefighters who are hungry to learn and improve. Our mission is to passionately pursue excellence through authentic blue-collar training. Come celebrate the 5th year anniversary, February 7th through 10th, 2024, on the beautiful beaches of Okaloosa Island, Florida. For more information, check out their website at www.northfloridafireexpo.com. Again, that's www.northfloridafireexpo.com. You don't want to miss it. We want to take a moment to tell you about some other great firefighting podcasts. First, I want to welcome my friend, Chief Arjuna George, who started his new podcast, Beneath the Helmet. You can find it on all major podcast platforms. Also, The Professional Brotherhood with Chief Brian Soler. The Five-Tool Firefighter with Nick Higgins of the Firehouse Tribune. Station Talk with Nick Higgins and Assistant Chief Tom Marciano. Flow and Vent. The Troubleshooter with Assistant Chief Tom Marciano. DTFF, Down to Fight Fire, British Columbia Volunteers. Better Every Shift with Aaron Zamzow. Firefighter Success with Captain Jim Moss. Code 3, The Firefighters Podcast. Make Do with Nick Peppard and Sean Duffy. Fire Rescue Show. Average Jake Firefighter and Fit to Fight Fire. Remember, to be a great firefighter, you must always be willing to learn. That's what we do.
Every year, over 1 million fires burn in America. Fortunately, firefighters are on the job, saving life and property, and you can be a part of it. 7 out of 10 firefighters and emergency responders are volunteers. There's no typical firefighter. Anyone can volunteer to serve their community. Volunteering as a first responder is really about having the heart and drive to make a difference where it's needed most. Your community needs you. Are you ready to answer the call? Learn more and find local volunteer opportunities at makemeafirefighter.org.
And that wraps this episode of 5 Alum Task Force, brought to you by 5 Alum Task Force Corp. One family, one mission, first responders helping each other. We'd like to thank our guest, Captain Dustin Lambert, for joining us to discuss driving under the influence of dispatch. Did you know you can find us and subscribe to us on all the top podcast platforms? Just search for 5 Alum Task Force. We also want to thank our sponsors, Insight Training LLC, the Firehouse Tribune, and LifeScan Wellness Centers, as well as our promotional partners, Chief Miller Products and Sites, Thin Red Line Decon, Hass Alert, Pry Guy Levers, and Nestabars, Silver Arrow Coaching and Consulting, the EFT Corporation, Health KPI, the Firefighter Cancer Foundation, the Firefighter Cancer Support Network, the Albemarle Sweet Shop, the North Florida Fire Expo, and the Great Florida Fire School. If you would like to be a guest with us or have a suggestion for a show, please drop us a line to info@5-alarmtaskforcecorp.org. You can follow us on Twitter and Instagram at 5alarmtaskforce, on Facebook at facebook.com/5, A as in Apple, T as in Tango, F as in Foxtrot, C as in Charlie. And on YouTube, please subscribe to our channel, same name, 5-Alarm Task Force Corp. Stay up to date with all the news about our podcasts, our nonprofit foundation, and our blog on our website, www.5-alarmtaskforcecorp.org. I'm Steve Green. Till next time, stay safe, stay well, and let's make sure everyone goes home.